For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, welcome everybody. My name is Jeff Gordon, and you're here to talk about the wonderfully delightful topic of helping people base in their life. And I'm glad that you came to talk about this, because I think this is an issue in our culture that people aren't talking about that much. It's one that people need to talk about, and I'm a physician, and I don't see the medical community dealing with this issue very well. And so that's why I talk about it here at the XSI, sort of year in, year out for about the past 4 or 5 years. Because I think that people that are at work in the church stand to have a real impact in helping people with these kinds of decisions. So before we go any further, let's pray. Lord, we believe that all matters of life are matters of you, that you are the creator of life, that you've created each of us, that we're eternal beings, and this life is significant in that we can come to know you in this life. And the whole matter of pain and suffering and facing the end of life is something that, to really live our lives in a good way, we need to think about how this life ends. So I pray that these kind of conversations would provide a framework for many of us to have the conversations about ultimate things with people, and that we can help them, though, with these kind of physical measures and the realities of this life. So we put this in your hands, and I pray that you speak to us. Amen. So I really think that it's hard to know how to live your life until you've thought about how you face the end of life. And in our culture, death is something that we put behind a veil. I wonder, in a group like this, there might be healthcare workers and whatnot, but you talk to most people and you say, have you ever seen a dead person besides an embalmed person? Have you ever been in the presence of someone when they die? Have you ever watched that process? And in our culture, what do you think most people say? No. I haven't been at the bedside watching someone die. But that's weird when you think about human history. It's weird because in most of human history, people have watched others die. You know why people would have a bunch of kids, even 100 years ago? Because they knew half of them had probably died before they reached the age of 5. It was just the reality. I mean, you didn't have immunization, so you had smallpox and all infectious diseases. Now you get pneumonia, you go and they call it walking pneumonia, because you get pneumonia and then you can take some antibiotics and you're just on your way. But it used to be you get pneumonia, you're history, because it just takes your life away from you. Young people died of just simple infectious. You know, antibiotics have only been around since the mid-20th century, not even 100 years ago. You know, they didn't even have anesthesia for surgery until the late 1800s, when they started using ether on people. They had some opium, but as far as pain relief, the modern era, it's just so different than the way people have lived throughout human history. So people watched others die. But you see, we live in this modern era where we know enough medically and technologically that we can extend death. But the question is that life? And morally and ethically thinking, from a Christian perspective, when do we cross over? Or is there a place that we cross over where we're doing something that maybe even prolonging life, is that immoral? In other words, is it wrong to prolong a death? And so what I'm arguing for, I'm not arguing that we should decide when someone dies. I'm not arguing that I should tell you what you should decide about these issues. But what I'm arguing is that each person, because they're created in the image of God and they have dignity, should be able to make that decision themselves. Each person, that's what I'm arguing. Each person should be able to make an informed decision how things end with their life. And that's not happening. That's what I'm going to show you. Give you an example. I had a 92-year-old patient. This was not that long ago. I am a hospitalist, which means I take care of people after they come through the emergency room, they're admitted to the hospital. So most of our patients are pretty sick or pretty bogus. Okay. In other words, they just feign. A lot of people feign disease today because they want to get drugs, and then they get drugs and they take them to the street and sell them. That's just the way, the reality of today's world. But I get a lot of really sick older people. This 92-year-old man, I met him for the first time because he was admitted through the night and he was in our intensive care unit. He was in an assisted living situation. He had dementia. He was found in on the floor of his place unconscious. So what do you do if you find somebody unconscious and you don't have directions to do anything else? Call 911. They call 911. The squad arrives and this man is unconscious. He's barely breathing, so they intubate him. They put a tube in his breathing pipe and start bagging him. His blood pressure is real low. They start giving him IV fluids. They bring him into the emergency room and his blood pressure is still low, so they start him on IV medicines. They're called pressors that constrict your blood vessels and try to keep your blood pressure up. They keep pouring IV fluids into him. And I see him a few hours after he's been admitted. And it's obvious he's got this full body infection. It's overwhelming him. This man, he is dying. And, you know, when you've seen enough of these cases and you see a 92-year-old person and they've got this kind of, you know, he's headed the wrong way. And there's very slim chance that any kind of medical technology is going to turn this around. And so I meet his son there in the intensive care unit. And I just lay this whole scenario out to him. And so where this heads, though, is that, and like I explained to the son, is if your dad's condition continues to decline, which I can almost guarantee it will, because we can't turn this around at this point. I'm not going to lie to the guy, you know, give him some kind of dream of that we can do something that we can't. And when his heart stops, then we start CPR. You know what CPR is, trying to pump. But CPR is absolutely, positively, 100% futile. It will never work in a case like this. At least it will never work to any long-term benefit. And I told him that. This would just, if anything, do harm to your dad. He's like, well, you know, I've never thought of that before. And that statement right there, as many times as I heard it, still blows me away. Here's a 92-year-old guy and his 70-some-year-old son. They've never talked about this. They've never thought about it. The doctor's never talked to him. No one's ever talked to him about this. Does that seem crazy to you? That's to me. But it happens every day in practically every hospital that admits a 90-year-old patient. People aren't talking about this stuff. So I told him, I gave him my card. I said, you call me. You talk to your brother. You guys, you've got to work this out because I'm telling you, your dad is going to die. And the way his life is going to end is being crushed on by CPR, getting drugs injected into him. I don't know how much he feels, but this is not the way for anybody to die. The guy never called. And his dad died, and he got crushed for about 15 or 20 minutes, and then they stopped. Okay? It's not a rare occurrence. This happens all the time. You could go into most major hospitals, and you could find this kind of story at least once or twice a week. Okay? Why? Why? Because if you took that guy, self crushed by CPR, and you would have asked him before he developed dementia and these kind of things, and you would have said, how do you want your life to end? You can bet he wouldn't have said, when I'm 92 and they find me on the floor, take me to the hospital, stick a tube down my throat, and then crush me. How many people would want that? Nobody would. Nobody asked him to get a chance to make the decision on his own. And that's what I want us to think about. And that's why this. Imagine that you've lived a good life. Imagine you've lived a bad life, for that matter. And you're facing the end. You have a terminal diagnosis. You know you've got a couple weeks to live. Maybe you've got heart failure, maybe. Or imagine what that scenario would look like. What would you want? Where would you be? Who would be around you? What kind of symptoms would you have? What would you want? Where would you want to be? At home or in a hospital?
Home.
Almost everybody says they want to be at home. You know where most people die?
Hospital.
Hospital. Almost 60% of people die.
That's why you don't want to go there.
Almost everybody dies in a hospital. How many people would want to die in an ICU? Now, I mean, if you had trauma and this is... and there's a chance that it could save you. I'm talking about you have a terminal condition, you know you're going to die. Would you want to be in an ICU?
No.
No, you wouldn't. Would you want to have pain?
No.
You don't want to have pain. Well, they did a survey and they asked people, and patients with serious illness, life-threatening illness, they said they want controlled pain and symptoms. They don't want their dying process prolonged. They want to have a sense of control, even at the end. And I think this is just human nature. We want to be there's a sense of self-determination that we want to be able to call the shots. You see, if you don't give the people a chance to call the shots, then they get foisted upon them what the system says or what their relatives that they never talked to feel guilty, and they want to feel like they have to do these things for them. Who thinks that a shorter life is better or moral, right? So they think, what is the best thing for my loved one that I don't know what's going on is every tick of the heart we can get out of it. Because they feel guilty. They've never talked about these issues. But most people, when they're dying, they have this sense. They realize, they've come to the conclusion that there's things that are better than the highest number of ticks of my heart. Okay? I think we'd say that. That you cross a barrier when it's prolonging death and not maintaining life. And we need to relieve. They would want their family to not be burdened. And I'm going to talk more about that. And they'd like to strengthen. So they would like to be at home. They would like to have their people around them. They would like to die in that way. But what do people get? Well, half, and these are older. This is in an elderly population that this study looked at. Half of them had severe pain in the last 3 days of life. And that was the top thing that people said they would want to avoid. They want to have their symptoms controlled. Other symptoms that people have are shortness of breath, they have nausea, they have anxiety. These things are easy to control. I have a subspecialty too in hospice and palliative medicine. And you can control these symptoms. People don't have to suffer in this way. But by and large, people aren't trained in these palliative kind of measures, and people suffer. It's unfortunate. 38% in this study spent more than 10 days in an ICU in a coma. And people say they'd rather die at home. They wouldn't want this kind of care. This is an older study, but it holds true today. These same sort of things. So this is the problem, the way I see it. People receive care that they would decline if we would give them the opportunity. Now, again, I'm talking, this is the case. Usually older people that know that they have serious illnesses, their health is declining. I'm not talking about a young person. I'm in my 50s, I consider myself still young. That has a traumatic event or something like that where, I mean, ICU care, intensive care unit care, really works for people that are salvageable, okay? But there are some people that are not salvageable. And you see, that's where our system sort of goes off the tracks. And we have studies, we have a pretty good idea. My main job is ministry, but I still do 1 week a month in hospital care. And last time I was on service, I worked at Graham here. We had a 21-year-old girl that had a septicemia staph. She had a pimple on the back of her leg. Got it settled in her heart. She had septic emboli that crawled all over her lungs. She developed shock. She developed multi-system organ failure. And she walked out of the hospital. Okay? And we were at her bedside. You know, we pulled out every stop and everything that we knew how. And I thought about her all the time for like 3 days. And we all did. And she got better. You know, but that happens to somebody that's older. They just don't have the reserve, you know, to recover from those kinds of things. So ICU care, heroic measures, they really work some of the time. I mean, that girl still could have died, and she's very fortunate that, and we prayed for her a lot too. But this is the problem, and again, I'm not saying I'm going to determine who gets it and who doesn't. That's what I want to just make that very clear. I'm not saying I want to pick you get it, you don't. What I'm saying is you get to decide yourself. And what I'm telling you is that people don't get to decide. And I'm going to show you even more data that'll hopefully convince you on that point. So the result is, one, the patients suffer. Why do they suffer? Well, they're receiving, this care is not just benign. You know, it's not like, you know, taking an aspirin. The kind of care that they get is, it injures them in some ways. Just 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago now, our neighbor, we had these two sister neighbors that they've not married, they have no children. Their closest relatives are second cousins that live 4 hours away that they've only known for the last 15 years. And we've lived by them for 27 years. And my wife is sort of like a daughter to them. And they came over to get us and said, come, you know, Phyllis is sick. I went over and she was real weak. I thought she just had, you know, like a urinary tract infection a lot of time. Well, they took her in and her liver was full of cancer. And she had a tumor, a big tumor in her bowel. And, you know, as it turns out, she hadn't been out of bed for a couple of days. You know, she was dying. She was yellow. She had jaundice. Her liver function test showed that she had liver failure. And still, the doctors offered her a surgery to take that colon cancer out because they said it might obstruct, which is true. But this lady's dying. You know, and so we talked about it, and I said, would you want this? She says, oh, no, I'm ready to go now. She was a Christian. She knew where she was going. And I said, praise God, you know, because they would have killed her with the surgery, or she wouldn't come off the ventilator because she was weak. So she would have died in an ICU with all this care. So that's what I said. But I don't think these physicians, it's not like they're hostile to the patients or that they just want to do another procedure. But they say things like, well, I want to give them hope. There's hope that there's something that we can do here. And I see this all the time in oncology, offering patients chemotherapy treatments for illnesses that are so far advanced, and maybe we'll give them a couple more weeks. We've got to give them hope. But they don't, oftentimes don't talk to them about the adverse effects and the side effects. We've got to give them something. And a lot of times it's the physician dealing with their own sort of limitations too. But it's in every sort of specialty of medicine, whether it be surgery or medical, this idea that more must be better. We've got to give them something. But a lot of times something hurts people. You know, not it's not deliberate, it's just an adverse effect of a treatment. I mean, to be cut open and a colon cancer taken out, then you're going to die with abdominal pain from the incision. And who knows what else? Probably with at least an NG tube down your nose. So anyway, people suffer when they get too much care, I think. And again, I don't want to decide, but I want that person to have all the facts so they can decide for themselves. The risks, the benefits, and the alternatives. But here's this other thing, and this has just come to light in the last few years. The decision makers suffer, because here's what happens. Okay, here's an older person. They come into the emergency room. And in the Medicare population, which is over 65, and 65 is not that old in today's lifespans, with people living into their 80s real commonly. But still, in the Medicare population, if they're admitted to the hospital, so like the kind of patients I see, they come through the emergency room, they're sick enough, they have to be admitted to the hospital. Half of those patients lack decision-making capacity. Not that they did before, but because of their illness or because of a previous thing, they can't make a decision themselves. You got that? Half of Medicare, the population that's admitted to the hospital, can't make a decision. So who makes the decision for them? Well, a decision maker other than themselves. We call that a surrogate decision maker. Now, you can designate a surrogate. There's a form called a healthcare power of attorney. But you know what? Less than 20% of people have a surrogate designated. So then it falls to someone else, and it goes in order from spouse to oldest child and right down the list. Okay? If they have no decision maker, then we have to get they become a ward of the state, and we get a legal guardian. But someone has to act as their decision maker. And we can't, I mean, in an emergency situation, we make decisions for people. But in general, like whether or not you operate on that colon, whether you take chemotherapy, whether you get resuscitated, someone has to make that decision. Well, these people that get, you know, thrust into that position to make the decision, the wife, the child, maybe that this could happen to you. Your parent gets sick. They never talk to you about what they want. You don't know what they want. You don't know if they want to be on a ventilator. You don't know if they want tube feeds. You don't know if they want CPR. But you have to make the decision for them. How would you like that? Would that be hard on you? Heck yeah, it'd be hard. Especially if you didn't know what they wanted. And in the cases of people that don't know what they want, there's a really significant impact. This was a study that looked at the effect on surrogates of making treatment decisions. And they found that a third of surrogate decision makers experience stress, anxiety, or other emotional burden as a result of making or helping to make treatment decisions for an incapacitated adult. And that makes sense that it would be stressful, but as they go on, what they found is that it could be lasting. The emotional burden placed on the decision maker could impair their judgment so that their decisions might not be in the patient's best interest. So, what they're saying here is it's a stressful situation. They don't know. In other words, the question that I always try to ask people is this. It's the daughter making the decision for the mother. What would your mother want in this situation? So I try to help them see they're not making, it's not their values. They're trying to serve as a proxy for this person. So the question is not what would you want, the question is what would she want, okay? So you try to help them out in that way. And there are other things that we can do, and a lot of people ask me, well, what would you want? And I say, well, in this situation, this is the way I would look at it, but the question is still, what would she want? So we're trying to bring that out. But what we're saying here is that this emotional burden oftentimes disrupts the thinking of this person so that they may not even act in the best interest of this one. I got stories, but I better keep going. Most important, the data provide compelling evidence that knowing the patient's treatment preferences substantially influence the effect on the surrogates. Well, that makes sense, right? In other words, if daughter has to make a decision for mother and she has no clue, they never even talked about it. And it's amazing to me. I'm like, so have you talked to your mother about what you would want here? And it's amazing. Most people say, no, we never talked about that. And you're like, I've heard that so many times and it still blows me away. But they don't want to talk about it. I've heard elderly people, they say, I tried to talk to my son about this and he says, oh, you know, you're not going to die.
Really?
Yeah, we all are. Why can't we talk about this? Okay, so we just, again, we put the veil over it. It's not going to happen to us. It's not going to happen to our family. But in the cases, and this took in both quantitative and qualitative studies. And so what they did is they went back and they looked at the people that weren't affected, the surrogates that weren't affected adversely from me, and they said things like, I was just doing what he wanted. So you totally take the burden off your loved ones. They know what you want. They're acting in your best interest along the lines that you designate and take them. And so you've given them a gift of freedom and lack of guilt. But their conclusion was that making treatment decisions has a negative emotional effect on at least one-third of the surrogates, which is often substantial and typically lasts for months. Or sometimes years. Future research should evaluate ways to reduce this burden, including methods to identify which treatment options are consistent with the patient's preferences. Well, that's an academic way of saying people need to talk in their families. Okay? Surrogate decision makers, they need to anticipate that and talk to their loved ones. So the point here is that decision makers suffer. Any questions so far? Okay, well, there's this other one, and this is kind of controversial, but I think we need to talk about it. It's talked about in the news. Society suffers. What I'm talking about is the cost of healthcare. And I am not saying that elderly people shouldn't get healthcare. I'm not saying that there should be some panel that decides. I'm still coming back to this issue that people need to be able to decide for themselves But the truth is, if people decided for themselves, they would say no to a lot of expensive health care. You see what I'm saying? If people were to, given the facts so they could decide for themselves, they would say no to a lot of expensive health care. An ICU is $5,000 to $10,000 a day. Remember that study? The people that said they'd rather die at home, but they spent greater than 10 days? That's $100,000. Take $100,000, peel it off, put it in the toilet, and flush it. It's worse than flushing it down the toilet because those people got injured. And they got subjected to care that they'd say no to. It's just stupid. It's morally wrong, on one hand, that you subject someone to a treatment that they would say no to. That's wrong. But two, then the resources are limited. You know, money for health care or anything doesn't grow on trees, right? So why wouldn't we just at least acknowledge this reality that we are, and I don't like to use the word wasting, but I think it's not a wise use and it's not a moral use of our resources. And it's huge because here's the thing, 30%, it's year by year, it's about 25 to 30% of Medicare spent in the last year of life. Now, you would think that it would be greater, right? I mean, because in the last year of life is when disease burden is more evident and it's coming to light. But, you know, 15% is in the last 2 months. And you can see why. You know, these ICU cares, people get surgeries and these kind of things. But you know how much that is? Okay. What was in 2009, if you think of Medicare, 15% of Medicare. Most people don't realize the scale of this. You'd think $700 million, that's a lot of money, right? A billion is 1,000 million. Okay? That's a lot. It's hard to even conceive of a billion. 7 billion, that's 70. Well, you know what it is? It's 70. See, that's why this is just Medicare. $70 billion is spent in the last 60 days of life. That was in 2009. That's going up. Okay? It's going up because in the next 20 years, the Medicare population will double. What's that?
Baby.
Yeah, but it's going to double in the next 20 years. And so this, I mean, what I'm saying is not rationing. I'm not saying withholding. I'm saying let people choose. This is going to be crazy. Because we spend so much money on care that people would refuse if we gave them the chance to. And I think that's, from my standpoint as a Christian participant in society, I think that we have a moral obligation to do what is best for the society in which we live, don't we? And if we see that there, I mean, what if you saw somebody that was using resources that could be used to help? You know, there are a lot of people that have no resources for health care. Right? Does it seem wrong to you that we would give people care that they would decline, that we spend money there, and then we turn around and a young man that has hypertension, no insurance, comes in with heart failure because he just didn't have the medicine that cost $4,000 because he can't go to the doctor? Where's the morality in that? And so I think we've got to, you know, stand back for a minute. And again, I'm not talking about anyone rationing anything. I'm not talking about me deciding for another person. You get the care, you don't. All I'm saying is one thing. Let the person make decision. Okay? Because a lot of times people are like, you know, well, you're withholding care from the elderly. I'm not withholding any. I'm trying to empower them to make their own decisions. In Ohio, by 2040, half the state revenue will pay for nursing homes at the current rate. In Ohio, we have more people per capita in nursing homes than any other state. And it's in part because we have the strongest nursing home lobby. That have effectively lobbied against measures for more home care and that sort of thing. But I remember the $70 billion? That was just Medicare. Not Medicaid. Medicaid is what pays for nursing homes. So if you looked at the last year of life and the total cost, it's well over $100 billion. Okay? And I'm not saying truncate the last year. You hear what I'm saying? There are ways that, and you're going to see some other evidence. So I say that society suffers. And when society, we need to put faces on society. And if you could see the people I see that suffer because they don't get the most basic health care, you know what I mean. They are suffering. Well, this seems like an undaunted, how do we deal with this? Well, we've dealt with other medical problems before. More doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette. What's the point here? Well, back in the 40s when this came out, people thought cigarettes were healthy. Okay, and we've been able to show that that's not. This is a great health care thing. This. Eat, 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 and always stay thin. Fat, the enemy that is shortening your life, vanished. How? With sanitized tapeworm. Jar packed. Easy to swallow. That's an advertisement from the 30s. You know, so you can see that people have always been looking for. It says here, no ill effects. And easy to swallow. Well, we don't use sanitized tapeworms anymore, at least as far as I know. But yeah, why? Because people have learned that this is probably not a healthy way to lose weight. And what I'm arguing here is that people need to learn. You know, and that's why I'm glad you're here. Maybe there's a couple people that you can talk to about the realities of healthcare and the need to do this. I'm just shocked that there's not more talk about this in the general media, in public health, but I shouldn't be so shocked because no one wants to talk about that. We all want to have this illusion that if we just pay enough money in and we have enough technology, we can just keep people going forever. But it's never worked, it never will, okay? So I like to, the way I come to put this together in my mind is informed consent. EOL is end of life care. Because informed consent means that each person, when it comes to any kind of medical treatment or procedure, should have these three basic things. They should know the benefits, the risks, and the alternatives. That's the basic premise of informed consent. So if I'm going to operate on your knee, okay, before I operate on your knee, you need to understand the benefits, why this procedure should help you. You need to know the risks, that you could get an infection and lose your leg. Okay? I mean, that could happen. Maybe it's one in 100,000, but that could happen. The doctor needs to tell you that. And the alternatives. Maybe you could take some ibuprofen, put some heat and ice on your knee, and you could try that for a while. Okay? That's the alternative. You know what happens? If the doctor operates on your knee and you get that infection and you get an amputation and he didn't give you informed consent, it's medical malpractice. Closed case. He loses. Even though it was an accepted risk, it was a known risk of that procedure. He didn't tell you that. He didn't give you informed consent. That is immoral, it's illegal, and it is censurable. Not only would he lose the malpractice case, he would be censured by the medical association. Okay? As he should be. But that 92-year-old patient of mine that was found dying on the floor, he never got that opportunity to hear the risks, the benefits, and the alternatives, CPR, ICU care, a 92-year-old man with sepsis.
Yeah. A lot of these doctors have just given them patients a slip of paper, they sign this. And that's their informed consent. They don't verbally tell the patients. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. Now, is that libel there? Or?
Well, I mean, the patient is culpable too, because this is a relationship. So the patient could say, now wait a minute, I want to understand exactly what I'm signing.
Right.
Okay? But I don't think that's good. You know, the best kind of informed consent that I've seen is a friend of mine's an oral surgeon. And the Oral Surgery Association has developed videos, okay? And these videos go through what the procedure is, what the risks are, what the alternatives are, And so if they sit down and they watch it, and a lot of theirs are minors, they watch it with their parents, they check the box, they watched it, they signed it, they agree to it. Man, that's good informed consent right there. And that's the way, in fact, there are certain procedures in the hospital. We have a little hospital medical channel, and people can watch the video, because that way you get everything covered. And in fact, there's some videos that are emerging in life care that I think can help people. And it sort of takes the burden that way, that the physician, because that's the whole thing, it's all about time. Why is it about time? Time is
money.
Ching-ching, right? Mm. Yeah. And so that's really the impediment to these discussions in many cases. I'm glad I looked at that clock and thought, time is why? It is 11:05, not 11:55. Okay, so this is what, so other questions about informed consent? So the,
oh, yes. I have a question. I just want to know if you want to wait until the end or not.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I just have a question about your thoughts on adults with special needs who maybe are not verbal. I work with adults with special needs. And one of the people I was supporting was in his mid-30s and he had pneumonia. And he was getting to a place where, like, he thought it was bad, and so we took him to the hospital and ended up needing a tracheotomy. But the two doctors I spoke with both were like, why won't you let him die? But the reasons that they had said that to me was because they looked at him and they said, what's his quality of life? He can't talk, he can't walk. Whereas I know him not as a talking, walking person. I know him through his personality and how he, so now, like, but what I didn't understand was the difference between like a doctor, not like a like I can understand quality of life as a Christ follower and like listening to this meeting, like, of course, quality of life is not how many ticks of the heart. It's not the longness of your life, right? But like, how do you, like, as a person who, like, this is a young person, and you're saying, what does quality of life mean, like, to this person who can't give informed consent? And he ended up getting a tracheotomy, and he ended up getting, like, now he needs deep suctioning, but he's got all his personality back, and so he lives, he likes to play tug of war, he likes to grab my hair, like, that's all, those are still the things that were quality of life that I would have said, this is quality of life for you, enjoying eye contact. But it's like, who decides what that is, right? Because anyone else might say, you can't talk, you can't walk, like, that's a deterioration of your quality of life.
This is why the physician does not make a decision, okay? Because they can't know that.
Yeah.
Okay, especially in a special needs case. And that's why I don't want to make that decision.
For sure.
I want to help people understand the facts. But that person has a legal guardian.
Yes.
Right? And that legal guardian knows them.
Yes.
And that person makes the decision. Yeah.
Okay. Which they do.
Yeah. And so, and maybe the doctors are there, like, you know, and, you know, there's...
It surprised me that they didn't. I think it's what it was is that it surprised me, the values system. And maybe it's because I've been doing this for 6 years, and so I have a full understanding of the spectrum of, you know, walking and talking, thinking and feeling, and what makes a person's life valuable. And then also as a Christ follower, looking at that, being like, how, what's value, right? Like, our society says it's one thing.
Right.
But we all know the spectrum.
Well, I think... I mean, these kind of ethical questions are really important to engage, because, you know, what I'm saying here is I want to keep, I mean, life, the value for life is very high, right? What I'm trying to engage with is the fact that people need to be able to make their own decisions about that. In the case of someone who can, then they have a designated surrogate that understands them, they understand their needs, and they make the decision for them.
Yeah.
And I think that's the important thing.
Yeah, I think it just, if he hadn't had, well, I guess it just makes me wonder at, if someone, like, say, a guardian, like, he was made a ward of state, or whatever would be, it would be like, if that person was like, oh, well, that's no quality of life here. It would have broken my heart. They don't know that person, but like, whereas with maybe a 92-year-old who was found on the floor, like, they would say, they might be able to say, like, we can see that like this is not going to recover. Another person might say, well, what can they do? Can they walk? Can they talk? Are they going to be able to speak or go out again? Mm-hmm. But no, so therefore we should let this person die of pneumonia.
Yeah.
But like I would have been like, no, like I know that there's a chance
for him.
That, for this person,
right.
Because I know them, so
yeah.
I guess, I don't know. It's not
I think that's really important. And that's why it's important to have a guardian that knows them,
yes.
That loves them, and is engaged with them.
Personally,
and I'll tell you, there are a lot of imperfect things with the whole idea of legal guardians and surrogates and that kind of thing. Because, you know, on the other hand, I've seen patients that have been put through so much misery at the end of their life because their family is living off their Social Security check.
Oh.
And their family is taking their Percocets and selling them on the street. And I'm telling you, the stuff you see is hard to believe. So, it's bad. Okay, so with informed consent, what are we doing? We're trying to help people have the information they need to make a good decision, right? And that. This whole thing about apologetics we talked about. Faith is what? Gilbert Lennox just said it. It's putting the evidence together and it's responding to the evidence. And what we want to do is just, we believe people can make these decisions. They're complicated on one hand, but let's engage. Let's talk about this. Let's have a dialogue. Let's get the information out there so that you can decide for yourself. And, you know, if it was the case that people, you know, elderly people wanted to die in the ICU, they wanted this kind of care, then I really wouldn't have any problem with that, really. I mean, I wouldn't like it, but morally it'd be like, well, that's what they want, okay? And they've decided in advance that's what they want. But what I think I can show you is that people don't have the information. And they don't know these things. And it's very well illustrated by this study. This study was done in Boston. It was back in the 90s. But what they did is they took a group of patients that are over age 7. And these are hospitalized patients. And they asked them one question. If your heart stops in the hospital, what do you think the chances are you will survive and be discharged from the hospital? Okay? Survival to discharge. You think about that. Someone over 70, they're in a hospital, they're in a mecca of medical care, and their heart stops. What do you think the chance is they survive to discharge? Not just survive the CPR to get a beat, survival to discharge. Okay, so they ask these people over age 70, and they're in, talk about mecca, they're in Boston, you know, Harvard, and all this stuff, okay? 83% of the people over age 70 believe they have a 50% or greater chance of surviving CPR to discharge. Okay. Well, what do you think? I won't ask you to vote, but you know what it is? It's about 5. Okay. So you see what I mean? It's I call it an information gap. It's like an information drain. Right? Between what people believe and what the truth is. 10-fold difference. 50% survival to discharge, reality 5 or less. Some studies in this population, it's 0. Why? Because when your heart stops, that's a marker. A marker that your life is ending, right? And when you're in this age group, this 5 to 10% even includes people who arrest in a cardiac cath lab, right before. So if you're up on the floor and you have pneumonia, for example, and your heart stops, it's probably down about 1 or 2% if you're over age 7. You think people don't know this? The title of this study was Miracles and Misinformation. And so they go back and they say, so where do you get your information about CPR and survival? And where do they get it? Well, this is in the 90s, TV, not internet. Okay. And so they went back and they looked at kind of the reality TV shows and everything that these people, you know, Rescue 911, and everything that they watch. And about two-thirds of the patients that had a cardiac arrest on these shows survived. Okay, so,
I mean, that makes money.
You know, if everybody dies that you try to resuscitate on TV, it's like, that's bad TV. You know, what's the glamour in that? You know, what about these great doctors? They're rescuing all these people. Well, the truth is you can't. In this population, you can't salvage at this point. The stopping of the heart is a bad sign, okay? So it's only around this, and so that's what I try to tell people. So here's what I want you to understand. In your situation, if it stops, you know, the chance of getting you back is real low. And besides that, there's a 40% chance. In other words, of the 5% that survive to discharge, almost half of them have a pretty big stroke. Okay? So they're not going home. Survival, this is just discharge. Whether they're going to a skilled nursing facility, most of them at least a skilled nursing facility, they're going to a nursing home. They have these long-term acute care hospitals now because Medicare only pays for so much. So they just scramble, get them out of to those places as soon as we can. Because we're not making money if they're in our place and not in theirs. But here's the sad part. If only 5% are surviving, but two or three out of 10, we get them back. And if we get them back, where do they go? Well, then they're the ones that are in the ICU on a ventilator and lingering there for untold periods of time. So it's brutal in a lot of ways. And if this is what you want, okay. But the case I'm making, and you can see if you compare this to this, is that people are not making informed decisions because they don't have the information. I'm not saying they can't make it. I'm saying if they had the information, what I'm saying is they don't have the information, so they can't make it. Right? They can't make an informed choice. Here's another situation. If you had advanced dementia, lived in a nursing home, and developed pneumonia, that is pneumonia that you could die from, what would you want? And then when I say advanced dementia, here's what I mean. This is far advanced dementia, what we call a fast six. So you're in bed. You're incontinent. You can't recognize your loved ones or anyone. You probably speak less than 6 intelligible words per day. That's bad dementia, okay? Advanced dementia. If you're in that case and you get pneumonia we call the old man's friend, okay? I give you two choices. One is take me to the hospital, treat me, and then take me back to the nursing home if I make it. Or you could say, don't hospitalize me, keep me comfortable so that I can die naturally. And I won't even ask for a raise of hands, but they've done studies on this, and they show about 96% of people choose this. If you go on the streets, about 96% of the population say, don't hospitalize me, give me comfort care, take care of my pain, treat my symptoms. Most people, and I think it's over 80%, say, don't even give me antibiotics. Just let me go. That's not me anymore. I don't want to be a burden on my family. If I'm in that situation, I don't want my children to have to come and feel like they got to visit the shell of a human being. I'm ready to go be with the Lord. Let me go. Release me. Paul, he even said it. He says, I long to be with Christ, but I'm stuck here with you rascals for now. So as a Christian, we realize that this life is this blip. And I don't think that lowers the value of life. What it does is it raises the value of what we live for. Okay? This, and in any other era of human history, there's no choice here, right? People, they just slip off into sleep and they die. But we're in this quandary where we can, we can take this, and we do it all the time, to the hospital. Here's a study, okay? In the U.S., what percentage of patients with severe, the one I just described to you, that level of dementia, who live in a nursing home, have do not hospitalize orders. In other words, comfort care only, don't treat my pneumonia, let me here to die naturally. This was a big study. They studied this question. What percentage of patients with severe dementia have do not hospitalize or? I don't even give you 96%, which the study said the people said. It's someplace down here. It's 7. Only 7% of people that are in U.S. nursing homes that have severe dementia, in bed, incontinent, hardly able to speak, have to have help feeding. Only 7% of those are granted the dignity to die there of natural causes. I think it's reprehensible. It's wicked. And there are a lot of sources. Nursing homes don't make money if they don't have a full bed. Hospitals don't make money if they don't admit patients. Doctors don't make money if they don't charge for services. And people are afraid to talk about that. So there's a whole swirl of evil that has culminated in this kind of wickedness. And I call it wickedness because what do we know? We know that 96% of people that faced with this would choose not to be hospitalized, but would choose COVID care. So that's why we need to talk about this, folks. This is broken. This study, this was done in 2007. This is a recent study, folks. I mean, in medicine, if anything within the last 5 years is considered recent, okay? It was a big study. And Susan Mitchell, she's the head of the Harvard Gerontology Group. She's the one that's talking a lot about this. But only 7.1% of nursing home patients with advanced dementia have do not hospitalized. You know, the other thing that's really bad about this is that when you take a person with dementia, even at this level of dementia, they become accustomed to their environment. And you take them out of that environment, you put them in a hospital, and you just add to their torture. Because now they're disoriented a lot of times, and when a demented, even though they're bedbound, a lot of times they can roll around, so they end up restrained. It's bad on every possible front. This is not good. Now, if they're in a situation where they can't control their symptoms in the nursing home, then they, and still, if you have do not hospitalize orders for nursing home patients, you can still trump that or override that if you cannot control symptoms in that environment. So if they had symptoms of pain or they had a bowel obstruction or something like that where you couldn't control their symptoms, you take them to the hospital. You know, that overrides a do not hospitalize comfort care only type of order. This guy, Angelo Velendez, he's with that Susan Mitchell group. They developed this video decision support tool for advanced care planning and dementia. So what they did is they then created this video, and I mean, it went through rigorous review by their ethics committee at Harvard, and you know, all kinds of ethicists looked at it. You know, it's not manipulative. It's the highest level of rigor that anything like this could be exposed to, as far as academic medicine is concerned. That you can see these videos at that website, but what they said, what they found. I'll ask you the question. If people with the mean age of 75 were educated about advanced dementia and treatment options, what percent would want life prolonging care? And I think by now you probably know it's going to be down here on this end. And it is, 4%. So see why this is totally flip-flopped? What's happening? 93% are getting it, and only 4% want it. Stinks, doesn't it? It's crazy. And so they suffer and they go back to the hospital, and it's mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling. I can't tell you how many patients I've seen just come back and sometimes you talk to the family members and they don't get it because they haven't been they're getting this all at the end. They haven't. It needs to be in sort of the flow of life that we're talking about these issues more, so it just doesn't come up at the end in this stressful sort of circumstance. So, informed consent, benefits, risk, and alternatives. So, what are some of the alternatives in the face of serious illness? That's what we need. If we're going to throw stones, what alternative do we offer? Well, the whole discipline of what we call palliative medicine focuses on symptom control. And everyone should have symptom control. You know, when it comes to pain, shortness of breath, nausea, anxiety, depression, all these kinds of things that happen in the face of serious illness. But there's a sort of a specialty of medicine called palliative medicine. And in this realm, we focus on trying to identify the discomforting symptoms and treat those. And I think you can see from the study, you know, how many people died with severe pain. And we didn't go into the other symptoms, but a lot of those symptoms aren't controlled. And so, instead of saying, okay, you've got cancer, there's nothing we can do. Answer, you should never say that with your doctor. If you're going to be a doctor. Never say, there's nothing we can do. What you say is, we need to consider the goals. What are your goals? Okay? If we treat you this way, these are the things that you could expect. The benefits, the risks. And here are alternatives. So here's a person with cancer, metastatic cancer. That means widely spread throughout the body. You could have this chemotherapy. Okay, and here's what it might provide for you, but it cannot cure you. That's what I'm talking about, it's terminal illness. And a lot of people get, you know, some chemotherapies for some cancers give people a lot of life. Okay? A lot of chemotherapy for a lot of terminal cancer shortens it. Okay? So you need to understand that. But then there's an alternative, and it's not do nothing. The alternative, let's focus on controlling your symptoms, a palliative approach, and try to give you as much quality of life. Maybe not as much quantity of life, but let's focus on quality. Which means that you're not sick, your blood counts aren't low because you had chemotherapy. In other words, you're not sick. Nausea is a big problem with a lot of these treatments. You're not in the hospital, okay? But we'll focus on trying to keep you at home. We'll treat your symptoms, and it's amazing how many people, you go and you survey people, that's what I would want. Yeah. If I had a widely metastatic cancer, I'd want to just, let me go. I want to be with my family, my dog, I want to be there where, they can hop up on the bed with me and talk to me, I can play cards with them, and maybe I won't have as long, but man, I'm going to make the most of it as I can. I want this to be a good experience for them, because I know I'm going, right? And so those are the kind of alternatives that we can give to people, a palliative approach. Is that immoral because we take, because we don't go for the last 2 weeks? No, I don't think so. We're giving them a choice. You decide. I'm not going to decide for you. I'm going to give you the information and you decide. Right? And there's a set of palliative medicine called hospice care. And most people have heard of hospice. But for someone to qualify for hospice, they have to have 6 months or less as agreed upon by two physicians. So no matter what their diagnosis, if they, and there are guidelines for this. And, frankly, we're not really that good at predicting prognosis, especially in things like heart failure and lung disease. Prognostication is very difficult. But if two doctors agree that you've got 6 months or less to live, then you can be under hospice care. Now, when you go into hospice, there are a lot of things about how it's paid for, but it's not paid for in the same way that Medicare is. Medicare is fee-for-service. In other words, you come in and you have a surgery and somebody bills you. Come into the hospital, you have a diagnosis, and the hospital bills Medicare for that diagnosis. Under Medicare hospice benefit, the hospice gets paid per day for however long that person is in there. So it's called a capitation, daily capitated fee. Okay? Now, what's the difference? Well, when it comes to hospice, most hospices are what are called non-profit hospices. And they spend more on the patients than they get reimbursed. And they raise money so that they can do it. For-profit hospices do. But, and I think a lot of them are very good. But when you come into hospice, there is a multidisciplinary approach. Really, under palliative medicine, the philosophy is multidisciplinary. So you have a physician, you have a nurse, you have a social worker, okay, and you have a chaplain or a social or a psychologist. That's the minimum. To have a hospice, you need to have those members on the team. And in hospice, what I think is really sweet is that the spiritual needs of the patient are part of the problem list. You know, whenever you look at patients, they have a list of problems. But under hospice care, that there's an awareness that people have spiritual needs. And there's been a good bit written about it. I keep talking about Harvard because that's where a lot of things come out of. But there's a young woman who's a radiation oncologist at Harvard who's a Christian. And she has a group of Christians there that have done a lot of research about spiritual care and spiritual needs and lack of. And they publish stuff that show that some of the greatest dissatisfaction people have with their hospice care is their spiritual needs. So it's really cool because this is engaging then the need to have better trained healthcare providers, better trained chaplains and whatnot. A lot of Christians find their way into hospice care. It's a great way. A good friend of mine, his name's Bruce Robinson, he's a nurse, and he's led untold number of people to Christ in hospice care. Because, I mean, here they are, man, they got one foot in the grave and one foot on a banana peel, right? They're ready to go, and they're thinking about eternity like nobody else. And he's just there with them, and the nurse is there often checking in on them and developing a relationship with the family. And the other thing that's really sweet about hospice is, besides being a multidisciplinary team dealing with the different needs of the patient, they also deal with the needs of the family. They're engaged with the family. After the person dies, it's not like the door slams and they're gone. No, they have grief, follow-up for the family. It's very, very sweet. Level, they measure like patient satisfaction and family satisfaction with care much, much higher than even the cases where patients die under hospice care. My dad died just in May, and it was a very difficult situation because he was divorced from my mom and remarried, and his wife was very unrealistic. He had a terminal diagnosis for over a year, and they just kept pushing him treatments and whatnot, and so and he suffered a lot through the whole thing. But finally, at the end, they allowed him to go into hospice care, and he was only in hospice care for a week. But man, it was sweet because they were there, they took care of him, they took care of the family, and then they had follow up. So I would highly recommend it. And a lot of people, here's another question for you. Hospice is the kiss of death. In other words, you know, if they're just going to let you go. You're here to die under hospice care. That's what some people think. But it's totally false because there are many diagnoses that people live longer on hospice. And here's a study. This is the one that I wish all oncologists and surgeons would read. Okay, this is from March of 2007, and this is patient survival among patients who die within a three-year window. So these are patients that have a terminal diagnosis. They have terminal cancer. They have terminal heart failure. They have terminal lung disease. Okay, and it was big. Almost 4,500 terminally ill patients with six different diagnoses: cancer of the pancreas, lung, colon, and congestive heart failure lived longer on hospice. I mean, why? Are we doing good by them to keep? Well, it's not like they took all, I mean, congestive heart failure, it's not like they took all the medicine away from them. But the big thing, like congestive heart failure is when your heart is dying and it can't pump the blood and it sort of backs up in your lungs, you get swelling. But the razor edge of someone that's dying from heart failure is all about fluid and sodium. Okay, they eat a bag of potato chips and drink a couple glasses of water, and they're short of breath and their feet are swollen. Well, the hospice nurse, they call the hospice nurse, and she says, "Take another Lasix. You know, it's a diuretic." take another Lasix and don't drink anything today and put those potato chips away. But you know what? They're doing better. They lived 80 days longer on the hospice than they did under usual care. Congestive heart failure patients did. And what about cancer of pancreas, lung, and colon? Well, especially when you go into academic centers, they're all about these trials. And, you know, I'm all for people learning, but they put people in clinical trials and they just blast them with a lot of drugs. And those drugs are not benign, okay? They kill people. And so I think this study is not quoted to most people that have pancreas cancer, lung cancer, and colon cancer as well. Is not as an alternative that patients under hospice care for your diagnosis. And what I tell people is, do you want to live longer? And they'll say, yeah. I say, well, then go to hospice. You know? So, in cancer of the breast and prostate, there was no difference. Now, this is widely metastatic. I'm not saying that we need to throw out cancer treatment. What I'm saying is widely metastatic terminal cancer of these types do better with less care than more. But this kind of care leads to patient satisfaction, it leads to more harmony with their family, to have a better day. So why wouldn't you do it? And I'll come back to it, it's less expensive. 80 days longer with heart failure. So what should you do? Encourage people to complete a healthcare power of attorney. Why? Remember, decision makers suffer if they don't know what someone wants. So, I think everyone should have someone designated that they say, if I can't make a decision, I want you to make it for me. In Ohio, this is a form you can download. I'll show you where you can get it. Unfortunately, and the biggest thing that is mind-numbing to me is the form is 9 pages long. Okay? And all it asks is, who do you want to make the decision for you? There's all these other real simple forms that other states use. There's this one thing called like 5 wishes. It's one page and you designate who makes your decision. I want antibiotics. I want to be on a ventilator. I don't want CPR. You just, that's one page. Ohio, we got 9 pages just to fill in the one blank who makes the decision for you. So you take this 9-page document to an older person, what do they think? You're trying to rip them off or something, right? Because they're always getting calls. Telemarketers trying to rip them off. So it really undermines the ability to even get these things done. But still, do it. Get the form. Talk to people. And the most important thing about this is, okay, not only who do you want to designate, but what do you want done? Okay? So that they know. That's what a healthcare power of attorney. But then there's a whole concept in our state of a living will. And the living will designates what you would want, but it's under 2 very specific circumstances. If you are in a permanently unconscious state or you have a terminal condition, then the living will is active. So if in those cases, then what the living will designates, I don't want CPR, I don't want resuscitation, I don't want to be on ventilator, I don't want 2P. But it's only in those cases, permanently unconscious state or a terminal illness. So if you take an 85-year-old person who's, you know, and generally they're okay, they just come into the hospital with pneumonia. But remember that stat? What's their chance of survival to discharge? Not very good, right? But they don't have a, and he says, I got it all covered, I've got a living will. And no, you don't, because you are not in a permanently unconscious state, and right now you don't have a terminal, you just have pneumonia. Now that pneumonia, your heart could stop, you know, in 85-year-old people that have pneumonia for months, because a lot of them have coronary disease, you know, and they'll have a heart attack because they might have had that at home. But they don't want CPR. They thought the living will covered them. So what they need to do is to establish code status. Code status says, if my heart stops, what I want to do, do not resuscitate. You see, so that's why this is confusing for a lot of people. And this is the way it is in Ohio. They think they've got it covered. They don't want to be resuscitated. They filled out a living will. They said that in the living will, but they come into the hospital and they don't meet those criteria. So then they get resuscitation. So these are the issues that we need to take up with people. Code status, living will, and healthcare power of attorney.
Jeff, I'm sorry, just the code status was?
It's do not resuscitate. And that form is available too. The thing about, and I should say, healthcare power of attorney and living will are something that one can complete, they sign it, and they just need it witnessed. You don't need it notarized or anything, okay? But the code status is a physician order. So they have to talk to their doctor about it. The doctor should have it on file. A lot of them don't, so it's probably better to go to the website, print it out, and take it into the doctor. Yes, sir?
What's the difference between do not resuscitate and comfort care only?
Okay. I'm just trying to decide how much detail to go in because it's confusing in the Ohio law. But in Ohio law, there's do not resuscitate CC, comfort care only. In that case, any kind of, and there again, we have to talk about what do you mean by that? If this is you, do you want antibiotics if you get pneumonia? Versus in Ohio, there's this thing called DNR, comfort care, CC arrest. And that means that, okay, I want to have all forms of treatment, but if my heart stops, let it stop. That's DNR CC arrest. DNR CC means only comfort measures. So nothing that would actively prolong your life. Okay? So that's the case, you know, like the terminal dementia person. Someone who's in a state, they know they're dying, they know this is the end, they just don't want anything done with comfort measures. That's DNR comfort care only. But in the case where, you know, like if I'm 85, because I know if I ever make it to 85, I'm going to be ready to go, I think, if the Lord's ready to take me. And I go into the hospital with pneumonia, and my heart stops. I want to be DNR CC arrest, which means, okay, give me my antibiotics. I'll give a good shot at it, but if my heart stops, let it stop. That's the difference, okay? I'll take my antibiotics, you know, hydrate me up with some IV fluids, but if it's my time to go, yeah, that's DNR CC arrest.
Okay, let's give it the scenario of a 92-year-old lady that her husband is gone, her sister is gone, her brothers are... All she wants is... She can't figure out why she's living anymore.
Oh, yeah.
She can't figure out why she is around anymore, and she's asking the Lord every day, why am I around anymore? Why haven't you taken me?
Does she want to be resuscitated?
No.
She needs a DNR completed. Because if she's at home, or she goes to the ER, say she breaks her hip?
She has.
How long ago did she break her hip?
About 5 years ago.
Yeah. Well, in those kind of situations, you have to talk to her doctor to get a DNR. Because she absolutely would not want to be resuscitated. She wouldn't want to be on a ventilator. Let me go.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you need a DNR.
Probably. She almost died in that process. I mean, she broke the hip, she had the surgery, and then she went sour. She was going north. They revived her, did all the stuff that they needed to do. She was in ICU for 3 days. Mm-hmm. And we were telling them, you know, hey, this lady just won this. But she's coming back. She's doing well.
Yeah.
She's going to survive this. Uh-huh. And they did bring her back. She survived. And, you know, she was on a ventilator for 3 days.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's.
And did she wake up shaking her fist at you? Why did you bring me back?
Yeah.
I've seen that happen before. You know, they're ready. They're thinking this is it.
She looked at my wife and she said, "And why did you let them?"
Yeah.
And my wife said, "But Mom, they didn't give us much choice."
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We told them that you wouldn't want this.
Oh, okay. Well, and I think maybe that was a case they didn't really honor her wishes. You know, I don't know the particulars, but here again, definitely in her case, I think you'd want DNR, at least CC arrest, maybe DNR comfort care only. You know.
Okay.
But do you live in Ohio?
Yes.
Yeah. But you should get, in fact, I want to show you this. This is a really good website. And you see right here, it says download your state-specific advance directive. That's what these are called. CaringInfo.org. The American Association of Hospice and Palliative Medicine got a grant to develop this. And you can see, are you planning ahead? Are you caring for someone? Are you living with an illness? Are you grieving a loss? You hit these, and they've got a lot of, they're really working at providing informed consent. Because for a whole host of reasons, people aren't getting it elsewhere. And then there's, did you guys, I think that's in your notes, right?
Yes.
And then this one too, I would, if you're interested in this whole discipline, ACP decisions, that these are the video decision-making tools. And it might be the kind of thing that, that you could even show to some people, a loved one, to say, this is what I'm talking about. Okay, this is my book. It's called A Death Prolonged. And what I've done is, this is a story. It's not factual.
This, who did this? Who did this?
It's not factual, but it's an effort. Because I've always, the reason I wrote this little, it's just a little book, is a friend and I, we talked about this, about he's in a position. And we said, if someone could come with us and see what we see every day, they would be pounding their fists like we are about this. Because it's so immoral. What we're forced to do all the time. And to treat people in ways that they would say no to. I hate it. I hate it every time I have to do it. But I think the only thing, our recourse is to talk about it and to let people make informed decisions. So I hope a lot of you will talk about this. And it's one of those social issues that you know, a lot of social issues don't get talked about. And I think you can see that the scope of this is really broad. You know, if a third of people are having lasting emotional impact from having to make a decision as a surrogate for someone, think how many people today, if half the Medicare patients going in and admitted to the hospital someone has to make a decision, think how many people are injured today. Just those, besides the people that are getting mistreated in the hospital. So this is a major issue. It's a public health issue of proportion that's hard to exaggerate. Yeah. Oh.
It's you and then.
No. Yeah.
Oh, go ahead, sir.
Oh, I think it's wonderful that you're coming at this from a perspective, trying to make sure that we're all armed, that we can help ourselves, help our family members. Let me come at it from an acute care hospital perspective.
Yeah.
Are you managing to get any traction on this with hospital administration to program this in, you know, immediately after admission? Let's make sure that we have that discussion. Let's make sure we guide them, and also helping move the attendings from, we'll do anything, you know.
Yeah.
And there's always hope, and move them to, let's help you, the family and the patient, with what's reasonable.
Yeah. We are making some traction. I've been fighting this battle for a long time, and one of the greatest things that surprised the heck out of me, I work in the Ohio Health System, and Ohio Health here in Columbus is Riverside, Grant, Dublin, Methodist, Doctors Hospital, but it's Grady up in Delaware, it's Kent Memorial. Last year, our board voted to hire a vice president, system-wide vice president, Hospice and Palliative Medicine. And he has a charge to bring palliative medicine team into every one of these institutions. And the guy they got is probably one of the top guys in the world. His name is Charles Von Gunton. And he is the editor of the top journal in this field, which is the Journal of Palliative Medicine. So Ohio Health has landed this guy. So I'm like, praise God. But it's a fight, because physicians are rascally. We want to just make our own decisions and call our own shots, and we see it our way, and we think our way or the highway. So they're not easy to work with, but you know what? They see this. And the thing about it is we are not well trained as a profession to have these conversations. There's hardly any training in med school. And the only thing you're going to pick up in most residencies is what you get from a mentor. And a lot of mentors have never been trained, so we're way behind the learning curve. But you bring in a palliative care team into the hospital, then the doctor that's totally uncomfortable with this conversation, they can say, consult palliative medicine. And then the people with the training can come in and help. Yeah, do you have a question?
Well, I actually just kind of wanted to, I guess, build on his question.
Yeah.
Because I just experienced a similar situation what you had with your father. And my mom, you know, lived for way too long, and, you know, I don't know what you call it, advanced dementia state. And during the time when I had the opportunity to ask those type of questions, she just absolutely did not want to hear it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I read your book, I was sold out of your book, brought it up with my mom over a series of months, and absolutely didn't want to hear it. And so she, you know, is in that situation. Is there something we can do, you know, as the lay people, to be involved in encouraging the medical professional community, I don't know, through some sort of, a legal way or in a whatever, what can we do to be involved in?
That's a really good question.
Encouraging the medical community to.
I think whenever you hear talk about, for example, and I am not for, or I've got really mixed feelings about the whole Affordable Health Care Act, I think my biggest objection to it is it's like being broke and going and buying a car. Okay? If you want to buy a car, then you save your money, you cut your expenses, you figure out how you can afford it. But I don't want to get into politics. But one of the things that really troubled me is that the original legislation, and this was like in 2008, maybe it was in August or September of 2008, and there was a provision in that legislation that said that they would pay for primary care physicians to have a yearly conversation and examine their patient, that it included talk about advanced directives at the end of life care. That was in the legislation, and that is what became the death. Okay? And that became withholding care from elderly. Okay? It got politicized. And I think what I encourage, I think there's trouble on both sides, but I think what the wise Christian has to do is be able to see through it and say, now wait, what does this really mean? Because really what that provision would have made, it would have been good because it would have paid a lot of this is physicians. Primary care physicians are not advocating paid for services. They receive, and I don't know exactly what the number is, but a few years back, it was $112 up to a 70-minute. In other words, that's the highest that they could bill for their services. Okay. Level 3. Okay? You think $112 an hour? Oh, wait a minute. That's not how much he makes. That's his rent, his utilities, his malpractice insurance, his receptionist, his billing person, his nurse, and his aide. How much do you think he makes in that visit? And then they say, why aren't the primary care doctors talking to their patients about this stuff? It's pretty easy to answer. So this was, at least it was a move in that direction.
I have one thing just on that. You know, I think, number one, there is an issue, so to do nothing is irresponsible, and it should be addressed. That's unfortunate that people can't work together, but that's going to be.
Yes.
I have another question, though. In relation to cancer, and you know the ramifications of chemotherapy, but now today, radiation is a new type of treatment that's being used more predominantly. And my question for you is, my uncle had radiation. He had a melanoma that actually there was a tumor attached to his brain. He had 30 days of radiation because of this, though. He lost teeth. There were a lot of ramifications. It was 30 days in a row. Now, I share that because that happened. I work at Stroke Care Ministry, and we have a lot of people, a lot of requests, a lot of cancer coming among women, and prostate cancer, and breast cancer. But now I know one in particular is they're proposing 35 straight days of chemotherapy for the spot. You know, they got targeted. They put little bullseyes on your body, and they're going to go in for radiation. You know, my question for you, Jeff, just what about that ramifications? When do you do that much radiation, number one? And, well, you know, and you know what I mean? To, because it's, yeah. Do we know yet what the results are? Because you talked about
well, radiation's not new.
It's been around, but we hear more about it.
And I think there's what's called palliative radiation, too. Like if somebody has cancer in the bone, that's really painful. And you can radiate those areas, and it gives a good bit of relief, especially in the spine. So
can you get 30 days in a row?
Oh, yeah. That's okay. Yeah. Let's see. I think you and then go ahead.
I just want to say thank you for testing this stuff. My parents passed away after a while. It was kind of like more of a counseling, you know, what they were telling me. And you cover good message about all the results of a patient's okay, who's just thinking of our responsibility to society. And I would. Because I didn't have the part of maternity, my view with my sibling was different. My view was that the doctors are giving.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.